alcoholic. Steve told me beforehand I could speak for as long as I was comfortable or until 8:55, whichever came first, which is immediately gives me a predicament, because had I not entered Alcoholics Anonymous and learned a few things, you know, I would have guided my life by anything that was comfortable, and speaking in public is not comfortable to me, so I would just, thanks, I'll pass. But I've learned a few things about how to talk through that, so I'll try to do that. It's one of the many contradictions of my thinking is I always want to be the center of attention, and once I get there, I want you to leave me alone. And so that presents a conundrum as someone who's supposed to be sharing their story. But I think a lot, having, you know, I quit drinking December 30th, 1997, with absolutely no idea that it would last as long as it has. And within those years, I've thought back to where I've been in previous times and wondered what I ever would have imagined. Like when I first walked into this building about 40 years ago. This particular part wasn't built yet, but I was in a scout troop that was having a movie night overnight party here. I guess I was 12 or so, and I was like, man, what if I had known at that point in 1982 that here I'd be walking back into this building for an AA meeting in 2023? I was like, what in the world went wrong? But I would not have had any idea that although, yes, quite a lot of few things went wrong, there are enough things that went right, too. I mean, the fact that I get to be here and speak at all, there are a lot of things that I did, a lot of places I went when I was drinking, where I have no right to be here at the moment, and I can only be grateful that I am. I grew up about 5 minutes from here in the neighborhood off Shoulder Sill Road. My parents moved here when I was about two. My dad was the accountant, chief accountant at Tidewater Community College, and they brought him down here to work. And so I was born with a cleft palate and cleft lip, and had a bunch of surgeries with the people who later go on to found Operation Smile. So I had a lot of that to go through, which didn't bother me too much until I started going to school. The kids would always ask me, oh, what happened to you? Are you in a car accident? What happened? Just being kids, asking questions. But I got tired of it. I wanted to be the center of attention, but I wanted you to leave me alone. I just wanted to be normal, and you know, whatever normal was, I wanted to be normal. That was, otherwise, school was fairly easy, in elementary school anyway. It wasn't until middle school that things started to get harder, especially math. If I had to ask a teacher for help, that's not my style. I'd rather go home and look it up in the book. If I can't do it on my own, then I'll just muddle through somehow. The math was a problem. And relationships with people in general began to be a problem, because I was always worried about what other people thought of me. And that was kind of what I based everything on. You know, I was only as good as the last funny comment I made, or the last A I got on a test, or whatever it was. I never felt very comfortable about that, and especially getting into middle school, it seemed like things got real shaky. I don't know why, but I look back on it later and it's like, well, maybe that's because, you know, girls and boys and puberty and all that kind of thing is starting to come along. Everything gets very competitive, and I discovered I got a quick enough wit. I can kind of be on the top for a little while. I can come up with a biting remark, and you know, until I can't. But it always seemed very unstable and very uncomfortable, and to me anyway. At home, you know, life was, my dad was a drinker, and I never thought too much about it. He was kind of the quiet drinker type. He'd get a six-pack or however much and go sit on the porch and drink when he got home after work. And, you know, he never went out, never had any drinking and driving problems or any big issues, but he just kind of isolated when he got home from, you know, after he got home from work. He'd been hospitalized for depression when I was five or six, which I didn't really understand. He went to some kind of treatment place in Connecticut. I didn't give it much more thought until I was 15. He killed himself as a result of alcoholism and depression, and I had no idea what to do with that. I mean, I already felt like I was the odd man out. I had no idea what normal was, except I wasn't it, whether it was being born with a birth defect or not being able to relate to people, so I thought. And this just added to it. So that, you know, normal people, whatever normal is, normal people's parents don't kill themselves. That's just wrong. We're going to a church at that time, and people came from church and tried to be helpful and said, oh, it was God's will, or it was his time. And you know, I don't blame them today, but my 15-year-old self said, well, screw that. There is no God who's going to take my dad away when I'm 15 that I'm going to believe in. And I never really became an atheist, but I had no interest at that point anymore in church or anything to do with God. What I did think a lot about was drinking. Now, I knew it was not the best idea. The most immediate example I could have had, my dad ends his life as a result of untreated alcoholism. I'm thinking somehow, and I never would have admitted this to anyone, but I thought, I'm going to get it right, though. He may not have been able to handle it. I am going to master it, or at least handle it well enough. And I'd seen examples on both sides of my family of how to do it and how not to do it. My mom's side of the family, I always remember being this kind of Norman Rockwell thing. And we go visit for Thanksgiving and Christmas, and everybody's laughing and joking, and they're mixing bourbon with the eggnog, and they're laughing a little louder than they were before, but nobody's throwing up and losing control. And I thought, this is what drinking can be. It can just make a wonderful, pleasant evening. Everybody's together and all this. Contrasted to my dad's side of the family, my grandfather died before I was even born. Nobody in the family talked much about it. They just said he died because the blood vessel in his stomach burst. And it wasn't until after I was well into alcoholism and doing a little research on my own that I found out that's a prime symptom of alcoholic drinking. The lining in the blood vessels weakened in the stomach, and that's what took him out. And he was a character. But he passed that along to his kids. My uncle, my dad's brother, came to visit one time when we were visiting my grandmother, and I wanted to go ride in his truck with him, sit in the back of the truck, ride down the river, all that stuff, and my mom said, absolutely not. And I didn't get it, because when he got there and he opened up the door and all the beer cans fell right out of his truck, I just thought he was recycling. I didn't realize he had just finished drinking those. He had not been collecting them since much before like noon that day. So I saw examples in my family of how to do it and how not to do it. And I had this ego, I guess, or this denial or whatever it was. Somehow I'm gonna get it right. One of the first times that I ever, and I planned it from the beginning. I was a planning drinker. So that, when I do this, I'm going to do it good. I don't want anything holding me back. So I had some friends who had this apartment over in Churchland, and they were having a party. I said, all right, I'm going to go. And I told my mom that I might be spending the night on this one. This could be big. And I'm sure she thought something might be up. But so I go there, and I'd never really been drunk before. Somebody gives me a drink. All I remember was there were red drinks and there were green ones. And I'm guessing the green ones are margaritas. I don't know what the red ones were. So I had three or four of those in no time flat. And by the fourth one, I'm starting to feel a little something, but it's not what I thought it was going to be. I felt like I had a cold or like it felt weird. And the next thing I knew, I passed out. I came to the next morning in the middle of the rug with mousse all in my hair and some foul-smelling cologne on, which I'm told I did myself. I have no idea. No recollection of that evening at all, which a sane person might have said, well, the drinking experiment just didn't work. My thought was, I got to try it a little more and get the hang of this, and so I did. The more I drank, the more I figured out. The two to three beer buzz. That was a beautiful place to be, except it never lasted. And I always tried to recreate that up to six and eight and nine and ten, however many it took. In high school was I started drinking a little bit then. I thought it was kind of a late bloomer because I didn't start until 16 or 17 or so. And I heard people talking about losing control, and it seemed like a really dramatic and wonderful thing that nobody could remember what they did the next day. I thought that was cool. And so I set out to kind of be at that place myself. I grew up, I went to Nansen Suffolk Academy and graduated from there in 1989. And back in 89, then the faculty could do stuff like have a party for the senior class that actually had alcohol. And they didn't care if the senior class drank or not. So we all went out to, I think it was Elizabeth Manor Country Club somewhere in Portsmouth, and got ridiculously drunk. And it was kind of weird drinking with the faculty, but I came to like it. I thought, I'm an adult. This is awesome. The end of the evening comes around, and I'd have way too much, but not as much as some other people. So I said, I'll drive this dude's car back to his house, from Elizabeth Manor, downtown Suffolk somewhere. I had no idea where I was going. I just thought, I'm going to be a public servant here. I'll help the guy out because he can't drive. And I'm marginally less drunk than he is. So I drive the car home and pull it up in front of the wrong house. I had no idea where he lived. And cars of the 80s had this little button thing going on to get the key out of the ignition, but I didn't know the car, and I didn't know where the button was, so I just left the key in it, parked in front of the wrong house. Hopped back in my car, which now had this strange smell of vomit that I couldn't really explain. Like it wasn't smelling of vomit when I left. I don't know why it is now. And three other people were in my car, the one who was driving it and two other friends, and one of them had hit the hors d'oeuvre bar a little too heavily, followed by some heavy drinking of her own, and had thrown up all over the back seat. So I drive home, not entirely aware of why my car smelled like vomit, because I was not in any great condition myself. Go home, get in my room, pass out. Next morning, Mom knocks on the door like 7 o'clock. My car won't start. I'm taking yours to work. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, that's... And it occurred to me as she's walking out the door, oh, wait a minute, but my car smells like vomit. And the stupid stuff like that in high school, but this happens to everybody. This is the kind of thing you laugh about 20 or 30 years later. she probably didn't laugh about it at that moment. And why I don't remember the details of that conversation, I'm not sure, but I'm sure we had a conversation about that. Things didn't start turning. So I realized even early on, before anything was a problem, I seemed to like to drink more than other people. Other people could have 2 or 3 drinks or so, or go out and share a pitcher, and when everybody else is ready to go, I'm like, I'll have another. Yeah, if you're having one, yeah, I'll have one. Why are we stopping now? I'm going. Let's go. So I took that with me to college. And in my freshman, sophomore year, I think, I was driving around one night drunk, because that's what I like to do. I mean, I enjoy driving, I enjoy drinking, and when the party's over and I don't feel like going home, I'm just going to drive around a little bit. I'm not hurting anybody, right? And I see some blue lights way off in the distance. Let me go check that out. And I drove today, yeah, I didn't laugh about that at the time. I do now. Today, I go so far as saying that was the God of my understanding, just kind of saying, this kid's going to derail himself if I don't kind of head him off the path a little bit. So I drove into my first DUI, right into the sobriety checkpoint, because there were lots of pretty blue lights everywhere, and I was curious about what was going on. So that was kind of embarrassing, having to call the roommate to come pick me up from jail, but I thought, I'm in college. People do this kind of thing. I mean, most people in college get a DUI. Come to find out later, most do not. But that was my rationale for it. It didn't really stop my drinking a whole lot. My license was suspended for 6 months. I had the little green paper I had to carry around with me, and I could only drive to meetings and to work and all, but that didn't worry me too much. 6 months I can handle, and I continued drinking. But the more that I drank, then the less sociable I got, because I realized early on I like to drink more than a lot of other people, and I still had all the fears and worries and stuff going on that I'd had from middle school or earlier, and so I got to the point where I just kind of like drinking by myself. I might go to parties. I didn't want to be a complete hermit, but that got less and less of a concern, the social thing. I got a second DUI in 1993, a year and a half after the first one, at which point the Commonwealth of Virginia was convinced that I was an alcoholic and sent me to AA, as they had the first time around. I went to an AA meeting on my college campus. And it was nothing like I thought AA was supposed to be. I thought AA was old people who drank coffee and smoked too much and all had gray hair. And I walked in this room and there were 15 or 20 people all my age, 18, 19, 20 years old. And they were all sharing these things that would have scared me to death to admit to anyone, but they were all in my head. All of my fears, all of my worries, all of my insecurities, they were sharing with each other and laughing about them. And in one part of my head, I thought, I'm home. I have found my people. These are the people I can really be comfortable with. But then that feeling left very quickly because I thought, they have a condition for this, and that condition is they don't drink. I don't like that. I mean, they may give up at 19, but I'm only 19. And I'm sure as I get older, I'm going to get the hang of this. Although I clearly had not yet. Two DUIs in a year and a half or two, I did not have the hang of it. And things continued to go downhill, and to the point where things just weren't funny. I could laugh about some of this stuff in high school, but around the time of the second DUI, Christmas, holidays, and drinking and I didn't mix very well at all. I wanted to go see the holiday lights at the Botanical Gardens, and I called my mom and said, hey, let's go. Mom and my sister still lived over here in Deerfield, and so I was living, I think, in Virginia Beach at that point. And I said, oh, let's go. And I thought, well, that's going to be a nice enough night. But, I had a little buzz, make it a little better, just a little bit of one. So I bought a bottle of whiskey before I even left and just had a couple shots before I went over. Had some more stashed along with me. And by the time we got to the botanical gardens, I was so drunk I threw up in the car this time around, but right in the middle of the light display. I got out of the car, and Mom drove home, and it just, I thought, that's ridiculous. And I knew then there was definitely a problem, but I wasn't just not quite ready to address it. The third and final of my DUI trilogy was in 1995. After I graduated from college with a suspended license, I didn't technically graduate, but I had an 8 o'clock oceanography class. It was a fairly interesting class, but it wasn't a top priority when I was drinking the night before. And I try to plan it. You know, I'd say, well, if I start drinking by 5, I should be okay by 8 in the morning. I can get to bed at a decent hour. It just didn't work. I didn't go to the class, and I flunked. And so I didn't have enough credits for graduation, and that was kind of embarrassing. So I went to the professor and asked, you know, told him, said, what can I do about this? Because we'd already had the ceremony. I'd already walked across the stage and picked up my tube that had nothing in it. And I was hoping to get the actual diploma. And he said, and he kind of looked at me. And I remember that look that I felt pretty much worthless at that point, because I knew that I had no reason to be asking him for anything. I screwed it up. He had no reason to grant me the favor. He did anyway. And I did graduate. But so that floated in the back of my head. Even though I graduated, I didn't really graduate, thanks to drinking. It didn't help any that I got a degree in communications. I wanted to be, I wanted to work at a TV station and be the guy with the camera who went around recording all the reports, you know, the reporters and doing the news and all that kind of thing. But they need a license, and I didn't have one. And that impaired my ability to get a job, which pissed me off. You know, it was more things going wrong, which, I knew drinking had something to do with it. But drinking also, it was no longer really an exciting kind of thing anymore. It wasn't, wow, let's sit down and relax. It was, my life sucks, but it sucks less if I'm drunk. And so I continued drinking. I got a job working at a retail store in Virginia Beach and was mad for 3 years. Until I got my last DUI in 1995, and I was pretty sure at that point that I needed to quit drinking. I didn't want to, but I was also pretty sure that having gotten a third DUI, driving on a suspended license from the second one, that I needed to do whatever I could do to impress upon the judge that he should not send me to jail. And so I thought I'd go to treatment. So I went to Virginia Beach Psychiatric, and spent some time there, and it felt good. I was talking with people. Again, I had that feeling I'm with my people, people who I can relate to and be honest with. And I connected with that to a point, but it was also kind of scary, because again, we had this thing, I have to stop drinking. And they even were fairly clear, yeah, you should really probably never, ever drink again. And the idea of never drinking again was terrifying. So even after rehab, I went out and drank for another 2 years. But again, I think of holidays. Man, that Thanksgiving of 1995 just stank. I had the court date for my third DUI coming up on December, is it December 7th or something? So I go to visit the family. And the families talk about all the things that families talk about when they gather for the holidays. Who got married, who had a kid, who bought a house, who got a new job, and I got a court date coming up. may even involve jail. And so I had, I felt, again, this, I always felt just a little bit less than, and I perpetuated it. I was beginning to realize that this time I'm making it happen. Nobody got me the DUIs, I did. And then Christmas stank also. After the court date, then I found out, yep, I am indeed going to the big house, Western Tidewater Regional Jail off Route 10. I spent the spring of 1996 there, from January through March. The judge took note of going to rehab, so that's good, and then still gave me 90 days. So I had that to think about in Christmas of 1995. So, well, Thanksgiving stank. Now I'm going up to Christmas. What are you doing for New Year's? Going to jail. That's what I'm doing. spending 90 days Western Tidewater Regional Jail, which I obviously didn't share. So I said, I think what I did say, because people could, my family could kind of tell, man, he's kind of down. And thoughts that went through my head at that point were, I'm 25 years old. I'm a third of the way through the life expectancy of the average white male. And I said that with a straight face, and the family just kind of looked at me and said, what do you say to that? Like, I'm 20, and I laugh at that now if I don't cry about it. That's pathetic. I was 25 years old, convinced that the best part of my life had already passed. Because people told me that in high school. They said, oh, these are the best years of your life. And I thought, well, shoot me now. I didn't like high school at all. If this is the best, 18, 19, no. But I did think that college was supposed to be the best years of your life. And I realized I pretty much drank my way through college. And so I was not I was in a bad place at that point because I really didn't think there was anything left. So I went to, got out of jail and kept on my retail job, and I kept drinking. And I finally quit drinking my birthday was December 28th, and people did not plan anything for me, bastards. And it could be because nobody even knew what my birthday was. I probably didn't tell anybody. I just expected that people, or I probably passed a few hints along the way. Ah, my birthday is next week, and then went on to whatever else it was. And nobody picked up on that and had a party for me. So that F you and got drunk, and whatever. And that was not a. I've probably been lower than that. So I don't know that was my bottom. But that was when I just decided this isn't working anymore. So December 30th, 1997 was my sobriety date, as I just decided this doesn't work. And I've been trying this for 6 years. It has not gotten any better. It's gotten progressively worse. But I wasn't keen on the AA idea. Even though I knew that it could work, I still thought, I went to some meetings in Virginia Beach. There was a place called the Open Door Chapel. And at the time, they had smoking meetings, and they had non-smoking meetings, but they're all in the same room. So the brown curtains on the wall stank just as bad in the non-smoking meetings as they did in the smoking meetings. And I went to those meetings, I heard people share, this went wrong at work today, and I had an argument, and this was horrible, da-da-da-da-da, but at least I didn't drink today. And I thought, oh, these miserable people. I don't really need this misery, and I ruled out AA. Now today, I look back on that, and I'd be really curious if I had the opportunity to go to any of those meetings today and hear what I bet there was a lot of recovery in those meetings. I didn't hear any of that because I didn't bring anything with me except misery. And so that's all I heard was misery. But nonetheless, I heard misery there. I wanted no part of it. So the part that follows today, I consider, is the God of my understanding doing for me what I could not do for myself. I'm not doing AA. I'm not doing these steps things. I didn't like any of that. Yet little did I know, in the next couple years that I went out after I had quit drinking, I was doing the steps unintentionally. The God of my understanding kind of brought all kinds of stuff together, or that's the way I choose to believe it today. I knew that I couldn't just quit, because I knew that, oh, perfect, I'm sober by 8:30. I knew I couldn't just quit. So I knew I had to do something with my life, and I thought, well, I like being outside. And I joined the Tidewater Appalachian Trail Club, but I had no license. I had no way to get to the meetings. My mom drove me to the first one. I thought, well, that's too embarrassing. I can't be a 30-year-old dude riding around everywhere with his mom. And so they had this deal where to go on their trips, they had this ride sheet where you could write down, have a ride, need a ride, give a ride, whatever. And so I put my name down and called the guy because they had a trip coming. And I said, well, can I ride with you? And he said, well, yeah, you can ride with me if you can get to Yorktown. Yeah, it was Virginia Beach. I said, let me look. And he gave the next number on the list, who happened to be a couple who lived 5 miles from me. And in the next couple years, took me in and adopted me, kind of like family. And never asked any questions. But because I had done those steps and I was just not drinking, always in my mind was the idea, they're going to ask me, why don't you drive? Why don't you have a car? Why don't you have a license? And it was probably not until a year and a half, maybe 2 years, through into this friendship that they finally did ask. It was always in the back of my mind. I might have carried that around all the time. They're going to ask. I know it. They're going to ask. And I could have addressed this directly, but I didn't. Till finally, sure enough, one of them said, hey, how come you don't have a license? Oh, no. And I said the first thing that came to mind. I said, well, I got a couple DUIs when I was in college. And before I could even say the rest, they said, ah, shame on you, and turned the topic to something else. I was like, that was it? That was it. I spent a year and a half worrying about how am I going to break this big, huge news, and it's over and done with in 15 seconds. So little did I know, I believe now, I was kind of doing the fourth and the fifth step then, learning that it's really not all that tragic to tell somebody else what I've done. And the big earth-shattering moment, odds are, is probably not going to occur. They're probably going to hear it and go, yep, anything else? What else do you have? So that was, I look back on that today and say that some of the fear I choose to attribute to the God of my understanding. I was too thick-headed to go to AA where I could have done it in 6 months or less. So it took me 2 years. But eventually, I learned, as people do here, when I share what's going on in my life, when I share the things that I've done with other people, it makes the load a whole lot easier. later, a year or two after that, I decided to try out a church. I had been going to see a psychiatrist also, which was helpful. I do believe, as it states in the big book somewhere, you know, seek out the men of medicine and men of religion, see where they're right. There are occasions where the 12 steps, miraculous though they are not quite enough to combat clinical depression and other issues. So I benefited tremendously from seeing a psychiatrist. Interesting also that, you know, the book writes about Dr. Jung, and the psychiatrist I went to was very much into the Jungian kind of way of doing things. Now, I have no idea if he had any kind of faith at all, what the God of his understanding was, if he had any. As a passing comment during one of our sessions, he said, well, you know, some people meet people in church, because I was still worried about fitting in and getting this social network and all this kind of thing. And so the comment stuck in my head, so I'll go to church. And I went back to church, and it was nothing like what I remembered when I was growing up. I'd written off God, you know, mainly because of what what the people in church had said after my dad died, and also because the God of my understanding then had these same kind of pesky prohibitions. Like AA says you can get this great happiness and this great contentedness and live a useful life if you quit drinking. Well, I didn't like that. Well, the God of my understanding had these other kind of things. I don't want to go along with all this. But when I approached it from a sober standpoint, and perhaps for the first time ever from an adult standpoint, then I could see that it wasn't anything like what I thought it was. The church that I found was a group of people who were all just kind of living life together and being honest with each other. It made me think of AA. It wasn't. It had a particular, you know, a different direction. But it was a similar kind of thing, acknowledging that they are not in charge of the universe, acknowledging that there is a higher power, that they are not it, and working together in the best way they can to kind of get through life. And so I stayed so there again, the God of my understanding is kind of working me through steps 2 and 3 at that point. I mean, I consider that I acknowledged step 1 when I quit drinking. I was absolutely powerless. It took me a long time because I thought, you know, I don't always pass out every time I drink. I don't always get a DUI every time I drive. These things don't happen always. But then I thought, well, but they do sometimes. And I have no idea when those times are. If I walked out tonight and decided, man, this talk went so well, I'm feeling so great, I'm going to have a couple beers. It's possible that I could have 2 beers and go home. But it's equally possible I could have 9. And I have no idea whether it's going to be 2 or whether it's going to be 9. And it took me a long time reading the doctor's opinion to realize I am one of those men and women who can never safely drink again. Doesn't mean that I pass out every time I drink or that I go to jail every time I drink, because those things did not happen. But I have no idea whether I'm going to stop at 2 or whether I'm going to stop at 9. And I'm not willing to risk that anymore. So so again, I stayed away from AA for years. You don't have to. If you come in right after you quit drinking and do the steps that way, that's probably the most efficient way to do it. I was a hardhead. And I laugh at this point by realizing that the God of my understanding, I believe, kind of directed me to do the steps anyway, whether I was in AA or not. After a while, I was in this small group at church where everybody get married except me. That didn't work out the way I thought. And I thought, you know, maybe I was too hard on AA. Maybe I really should give it a try, because church was good. I mean, I still attend, but there's something about AA that just keeps it simple, specifically with the contact with other people. And also that I can go to church on a Sunday morning, and now I know people, now I have friends there, that's great. But even then, they'll say, how are you? And expect me to say, I'm fine, and walk by and say, how are you? And I'm fine, and do this little dance, you know, all the way to the pew. There's still, even in that circle for me, there's not the transparency and the genuineness and the honesty that I see in AA, where somebody says, how are you? And they're really ready to listen. Or when I say, I'm fine, thank you very much, are honest enough to say, well, you sure don't look fine. And so there's an accountability there. So I thought, I'm going to go back to AA. And I thought, but hell if I'm going to go back to one of those meetings where there are like 5 people. And they've all known each other 20 years, and I'm going to be the sore thumb who has to introduce them. No, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to go back to a big meeting. So I pulled out the meeting guide, and I looked through, because I'm no dummy, I can figure these things out. I found a meeting that had babysitting. I said, well, if it's got babysitting, it's got to be a big meeting. And I can go there, and I won't get singled out. And that was the baby meeting at Talbot Park Baptist over in Norfolk. And I happened to go on their anniversary big eating meeting. There are tons of people there. And there's one guy there who's a familiar face. Said, wait a minute, I've seen you before. And he's the husband of one of my coworkers at the time. And I didn't know him well, nor did I know he was an alcoholic. But we knew each other well enough to strike up a conversation. He said, well, if you're looking for a home group, my home group's a men's big book study on Tuesday nights. Check that out. It's a great group of guys. So there again, the God of my understanding took me exactly where I needed to be, even though that was not my intent. I got put in with a perfect group a group I really got to know pretty well and felt very comfortable in, having no idea that that's what I was actually going to do. So seeing those moments in retrospect have helped me a lot on this whole idea of faith and the God of my understanding, higher power, whatever you choose to call it. I still, to this day, see him a lot easier in the rearview mirror than in the windshield. I want everything mapped out for me, and it tends not to be that way. But I can see, in retrospect, things that just turned out so wonderfully, I couldn't have written it. I'm not that clever, I'm not that lucky or that fortunate. I choose to believe that things have worked out in my favor through no particular power of my own. So that's how I wound up back in AA after a number of years of not drinking. And have found that it is indeed much, much better remaining in this fellowship. Because today, my issue is not drinking. I mean, it would be if I ever, I'm convinced, like I said earlier, if I picked up a drink today, no telling what will happen. And I'm not willing to risk that. But today, my issue is how do you interact with human beings on a tactful level and be comfortable with them and the steps teach me all of that. A Facebook thing came up in my feed a week or two ago. I posted it 11 years ago. Said, my train of thought has derailed and there were no survivors. And then having one of those moments. But so looking back at things now, just about time to wrap up. You know, the steps I was not comfortable with. The powerless thing, I wasn't real happy to acknowledge. The God thing, didn't care for that. Step three, turn my will and my life over to, that sounds like I'm going to wind up in a mission field in India somewhere. I'm not interested. But little did I know, while I was involved with this church, I was doing this volunteer program at a elementary school in Norfolk. And they did a tutoring, mentoring, homework kind of help Tuesdays and Thursdays afternoons. And I was kind of tired of the job where I was. And this, as I thought, this idea just came to me. I could be a teacher maybe. I choose to believe, again, that was the God of my understanding kind of redirecting me. Step three, turning my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand him. So now I teach elementary school, pre-K, Norfolk Public Schools. Nothing I ever wanted to do when I grew up. Had no plan on that. I didn't play teacher growing up. Wasn't a thing. It just came to me. I choose to believe that's step three put into action. And again, the God of my understanding has a sense of humor. Because when I was in college, I didn't do well with math. I didn't like math, but I had to take math anyway to get a degree. And so the course that I wound up taking in 1993, having no idea that I would be a teacher in 2009, was mathematics for elementary school teachers. So 30 years before I became a teacher, I took a course. I mean, it's just, you can't write this stuff. So that's been an interesting journey as well. And it's wonderful, the gift to me of long-term sobriety is being able to see all those things that have happened that I choose to attribute to God of my understanding. And I can see now in a way I didn't see before, it's not such a huge leap for me to get to God. First, I acknowledge that I alone can't do it. And that any me and one other person is all it takes to form a higher power. I don't want to drink and you don't want to drink. And the two of us can work together to get where we need to be. An AA group is a higher power. And I'd go along with that. It's not the mystery that I thought. I mean, it is a mystery, but it's not the unsolvable thing. You know, I can work with that. Like I said earlier, in closing, AA today teaches me how to live, how I can relate to people effectively. Because even though I put the drink down, still in my head, I'm not tempted to drink anymore. The thought comes to mind, but the desire doesn't. But still, I've had work has been challenging, And I think, well, how do I handle that with AA? Well, acceptance is the answer to all my problems. And I react, no, I'm not. I need to fix that, da, 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 da. But I have a community that I can go back and forth on this, because in my head I'll argue. So, well, no, acceptance is not the answer to all my problems. Otherwise, the Serenity Prayer wouldn't exist. It says I can change the things that I can, but I need the wisdom to know the difference. And I don't find that on my own. So as I was battling with what to do at work recently, I go to a meeting and this acceptance thing comes up again. Said, no, I've already been through this in my head. But in this reading that I never paid attention to before, it's, no, I don't have to accept everything. But if I challenge anything, it's my responsibility to do it positively. So I was able to work through that at work. I go talk to the boss and say, we need to take this to the top. And she said, okay, go ahead, just copy me on it. You know, so I had the composure and to be able to try and work to make changes at the office. But if on my own I would have just yelled at somebody, or I would have sent a really pissy email without checking with the boss first. You know, so I used the community, I used the fellowship today to help me react more sanely. I think I'm probably close enough to 8:55, but it's a gift. The one thing I read earlier that caught my attention, and to me it kind of sums up the steps. Is that, you know, when I drank, I wanted to recapture days that had gone by, or I wanted to not be afraid of the days that were to come, and I had no willingness or ability to actually be in the present. And I found this a couple days ago. I'd heard of it before, but it's this thing called destination addiction. And the guy writes that people who suffer from destination addiction believe that success is a destination. They are addicted to the idea that the future is where success is, happiness is, and heaven is. Each passing moment is merely a ticket to get to the future. They live in the not now. Destination addiction is a preoccupation with the idea that happiness is somewhere else. We are always on the run, on the move, and on the go. Our goal is not to enjoy the day, it's to get through the day. We have always to get to somewhere else first before we can relax and before we can stay for the moment, but we never get there. There is no point of arrival. We are permanently dissatisfied. We live in hot pursuit of some extraordinary bliss we have no idea how to find. Man, that was me. Anywhere from up to at least 1997, and periodically in sobriety too. But when I'm practicing a program, when I'm practicing these principles in all my affairs, or as many of them as I can, then I realized that all those slogans that used to annoy me, there's more depth to those. One day at a time, oh gosh. I want to be able to have a life I can look forward to. Well, today I do because of one day at a time. You know, I have things I want to do this weekend. I have things I want to do this holiday season. But at the moment, this moment is all I need. This moment in a room full of sober people, some coffee and cookies and some laughter, that's all I need. Because the reality is, without being morbid, I may not get home tonight. Who knows what happens on the road? And I don't look at that necessarily as being morbid anymore. It just means that I need to enjoy every moment, or do what I can to enjoy every moment, rather than worrying that it's going to turn out differently than I thought. Again, and like I mentioned, that driving drunk with my family in the car through the holiday lights. What if I had known 30 years later, I wouldn't have had the luxury of driving 15 minutes to see my mom and my sister. I get to see them. I'm very grateful and very thankful I get to see them this Christmas. But first I have to drive to Raleigh to see my sister. Then we get to drive to Pittsburgh to see my mom. So it's, and I'm grateful I have a license to do that. I mean, that's awesome. But I had it all then, and I didn't know it, because good was not good enough. And I thought drinking would make it better, and it never did. So I choose today, to wrap it up, I choose today not to drink, and it is a choice only because of the gift of my God, of the God of my understanding. Somebody at a meeting, speaker meeting, said one time, I'm not an arm's length away from a drink, I'm 12 steps away from a drink, and I prefer that. There's some humility in saying that I'm an arm's length away, and I have to keep that in mind. But the confidence that I get from saying I'm 12 steps away is because if I do this daily maintenance of the spiritual condition daily, and that is key, I can't do it every other day, I can't do it every week, but if I have the daily maintenance of the spiritual condition, whether it's sharing my story, whether it's reading a devotional in the morning, whether it's going to my home group, then I haven't felt the need to be drunk since 1997. I'm not sure I ever will need to feel the need to be drunk if and only if I do that daily maintenance of the spiritual condition. So thanks for inviting me to speak tonight. Glad to be here. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott.